The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the Director of Author Events here, and as usual, if you would please turn your cell phones off, things of that nature, so we don't have any interruptions, and we'll get started. I'm glad to see all you here instead of at the debates. A few years ago, Esquire Editor-at-Large A.J. Jacobs embarked on a humble quest to become the smartest person in the world by reading the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. As we all know from his not-so-humbly selling book, The Know-It-All, he succeeded admirably and now knows more than any of you. As he made clear in the first sentence of the entry on religion, quote, "I didn't grow up with an overabundance of religion." He's here tonight to tell us how all that changed. Please welcome A.J. Jacobs.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming out on what I'm told is Mischief Night. I never heard of Mischief Night, but it doesn't sound very biblical. For those of you who haven't read anything I've written, I just want to give you a little introduction to my writing. What I like to do is to immerse myself in my projects, to dive in headfirst and become a human guinea pig. I see my life sort of as an experiment or a laboratory, not a lavatory, although someone, I said this line in New York at my first stop, and someone wrote on their blog, he sees his life as a lavatory, and that was very disturbing. So I just want to, it's a B. I work at Esquire magazine, and a couple of years ago I wrote an article called My Outsourced Life, where I hired a team of people in Bangalore, India, to live my life for me. So they answered my phone and answered my email, argued with my wife, read my son bedtime story. It was the best month of my life. It was fantastic. I just sat back and relaxed, watched some TV. More recently, I wrote an article called about a movement called Radical Honesty. And this one is that you should never, ever lie. That you should, maybe the guy who started it is a psychologist in Virginia. And he says, never lie, except maybe in poker and golf. Those are his two. But he says, more than that, you should say whatever's on your mind should come out of your mouth. There should be no filter. And this was a terrible month. This was one of the worst months of my life. To give you an idea, the name of the article was, I Think You're Fat. So I don't recommend that as a way to live. My previous book was called The Know-It-All, and it was about my year spent reading the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z, or more precisely, from A-Ak, which is a type of East Asian music, all the way to Zivich, which is, well, I don't want to ruin the ending in case you haven't read the book. It's a very exciting twist ending, so I'll leave it a mystery. But that was I loved doing that. I loved learning all these amazing and bizarre facts. I loved going on adventures like going to a Mensa convention and going on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire to test my knowledge. And by the way, one of the characters in the book, oh, two of the characters, my brother-in-law and my nephew are right there. So, just so you know. Thank you. But of all of my life experiments, the one that I think was the most fascinating to me, the most profound and life-changing, overwhelming in a good way, was this one about the Bible, spending my year trying to live by the Bible. To tell you how it started because, as Andy mentioned, I grew up with very little religion. As I say in my book, I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So, not very. But I became increasingly interested in religion because for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's the defining issue of our time. I think it's incredibly important. And number two, I have a young son, and I want to know what to teach him about religion. So I decided to dive in head first, immerse myself in the Bible, and try to understand it by actually living it. The first thing I did was to buy a literal stack of Bibles. I had maybe up to here or up to my Adam's apple, to use a biblical phrase. And there was all kinds of Bibles. There was Christian Bibles and Jewish Bibles. A friend of mine sent me something called a hip-hop Bible, where the 23rd Psalm was rendered as, the Lord is all that, as opposed to the traditional, the Lord is my shepherd. So I read all of these Bibles, and then I assembled a spiritual advisory board, because I knew that this was a huge, massive undertaking, and I wanted as much guidance as I could get. So I found rabbis and priests and ministers who would advise me, 24 hours a day on call. Although they didn't think it was 24 hours. They were more like, it's 8 hours. But I thought it was 24 hours. Then what I did was I made a list of every single rule, piece of advice, and guideline that I could find in the Bible. And that was a very long list. That was over, I had it on my computer, 72 pages, over 700 rules. And they ranged from the famous ones that everyone's heard of, the Ten Commandments, love thy neighbor, be fruitful and multiply. And I wanted to follow all of these rules and see how that affected my life. But I also wanted to follow the rules that most of us ignore, the ones that don't get a lot of play. For instance, don't shave the corners of your beard. So I had, I didn't know where the corners were. So to be safe, I had, I never shaved for the entire year. And by the end, I had this huge appendage on my chin. And, I heard about 4,000 ZZ Top jokes, spent quite a bit of time at airport security. My wife wouldn't kiss me for the last 2 months. So that alone was a bit of an epic journey. But there was also rules about don't wear clothes made of mixed fibers. That's in the Leviticus. And I decided, I should, if I'm going to follow everything without picking and choosing, I got to follow this. So I went through my closet, got rid of all of my poly cotton t-shirts. There's a rule that says, if two men are in a fight and the wife of one of those men grabs the private parts of the other man, then her hand shall be cut off. So I had to follow that one. That one I followed more by default, where I made sure not to get in a fight with another man whose wife was standing nearby looking like she had a strong grip. So, And I tried to follow these throughout the year. And it was, as I said, an amazing experience, but incredibly challenging because these laws are not easy to follow. I found that there were two types of laws that were particularly hard to follow. The first had to do with the little sins that we all commit every day. I could follow thou shalt not kill. I was okay with that. But it's the little ones like no lying and no gossiping and no coveting. I live in New York, and I'm in the media. So there you go. That's 70% of my day right there. But it was fascinating to do this sort of ethical makeover. I loved trying to use the Bible to actually become a better person and see what it was like to see if I could make myself a more ethical, moral person. And I never became a saint. I never became Gandhi or Angelina Jolie. But I think I became a better person through the process. And what was really fascinating to me was seeing how the outer affected the inner, how the behavior affected my thoughts. So I almost pretended to be a better person, and I eventually became somewhat of a better person. It's almost like the business phrase, fake it till you make it. And this is on ethical and spiritual level. And it actually, I think cognitive psychology talks a lot about this. And it goes back to the Bible itself. There's a proverb that says, if you smile, you will be happier. And, that is a psychologically proven fact. And, sadly, I know that from an Ally McBeal episode about smile therapy, but it is true that, just this is a very powerful tool that, that behaving in a certain way will affect your thoughts. And the Bible, project taught me that. And oddly, this is actually a very Jewish notion, which I didn't know, but they talk a lot in Judaism. The Orthodox Jews talk a lot about deed over creed. First you do the deed, and then the creed follows. The second type of rule that was really hard to follow were the ones that will get you into trouble in modern-day America. And perhaps the paradigmatic example of that is stoning adulterers, which is mandated in the Old Testament. So I thought I'd read a very short excerpt of how I tried to deal with that. The Hebrew scriptures prescribe a tremendous amount of capital punishment. Think Saudi Arabia, multiply by Texas, then triple that. It wasn't just for murder. You could be executed for adultery, blasphemy, breaking the Sabbath, perjury, incest, bestiality, and witchcraft, among others. The most commonly mentioned punishment method in the Hebrew Bible is stoning. So at the very least, I figure I should try to stone. But how? I can't tell you the number of people who have suggested that I get adulterers and blasphemers stoned in the cannabis sense, which is an interesting idea, but I haven't smoked pot since I was at Brown University when I wrote a paper for my anthropology class on the hidden symbolism of bong hits. And I got a B+ on that paper, by the way. That's the kind of school that Brown University is. Instead, I figured my loophole would be this. The Bible doesn't specify the size of the stones, so pebbles. Today I get a chance. I am resting in a small public park on the Upper West Side, the kind where you see retirees eating tuna sandwiches on benches. Hey, you're dressed queer. I look over. The speaker is an elderly man, mid-70s. He is tall and thin and wearing one of those caps that cabbies wore in the movies from the 40s. You're dressed queer, he snarls. Why are you dressed so queer? I have on my usual tassels, because the Bible says wear tassels on the corner of your clothing. And for good measure, I've worn some sandals and am carrying a knotty maple walking stick. I'm trying to live by the rules of the Bible. The Ten Commandments, stoning adulterers. I'm an adulterer. You gonna stone me? Well, yes, that would be great. I'll punch you in the face. I'll send you to the cemetery. He is serious. This is not a cutesy grumpy old man. This is an angry grumpy old man. I fish my pebbles out of my back pocket. I kept them there just hoping for an occasion like this. I wouldn't stone you with big stones, I say, just these little guys. I open my palm to show him the pebbles. He lunges at me, grabbing one out of my hand and flinging it at my face. I am stunned for a second. I hadn't expected this grizzled old man to make the first move. But now there's nothing stopping me from retaliating, an eye for an eye. I take one of the remaining pebbles and whip it at his chest. I'll punch you right in the kisser, he says. Well, you really shouldn't commit adultery, I say. We stare at each other. Yes, he is a septuagenarian. Yes, he just threatened me using honeymooner's dialogue. But you could tell this man had a strong dark side. Our glaring contest lasts 10 seconds, and then he walks away, brushing by me as he leaves. Even though mine was a stoning light, barely fulfilling the letter of the law, I can't deny it felt good to chuck a rock at this nasty old man. It felt primal. And yet, I knew that this was a morally stunted way to feel. Stoning is about as indefensible as you can get. It comes back to the old question. How can the Bible be so wise in some places and so seemingly barbaric in others? And this was one I struggled and wrestled with all throughout the year. I asked my spiritual advisor, one of my rabbis, priests, and ministers, my spiritual advisor, Yossi, about the stoning. Yossi was born in Minnesota and calls himself a Jutheran. Jewish guilt and Lutheran repression mix perfectly, he told me. He's an ordained Orthodox rabbi, but he's never practiced. He's not fazed by my question at all. We don't stone people today because you need a biblical theocracy to enforce stoning, he says. No such society exists today. But even in ancient times, stoning was not barbaric. First of all, you didn't just heave stones, he says. The idea was to minimize the suffering. So what we call stoning was actually pushing the person off the cliff so they would die immediately upon impact. Plus, the stonings were a rare thing. Some rabbis say they only occurred once every 7 years. Others, once every 70 years. Also, the person getting executed was given strong drink to dull the pain. I half expected Yossi to say they gave the adulterer a massage and a gift bag. He made a compelling case, and yet I'm not totally sold. Were biblical times really so merciful? I suspect there might be some post-biblical whitewashing going on. As my year progresses, I'll need to delve deeper. So that was my attempt to stone. And I think it is in a sense emblematic of the project in a couple of ways. The first is that I mentioned one of my motivations for writing this book. There are basically two. The first was this journey to find out what, if anything, I was missing by not having religion in my life. What was I missing, an essential part of being human? Was I like a guy who had never fallen in love? Or was half the world deluded, like Richard Dawkins would say? So I really wanted to explore religion. But the second simultaneous motivation was I wanted to show that I'm concerned about the rise of fundamentalism, and I wanted to show that if you take fundamentalism to its logical extreme, you'll be acting like a crazy person. That taking the Bible too literally is a disservice to the Bible. That the Bible has so much poetry and metaphor and wisdom, but you can miss a lot of that if you take it completely literally, and you'll end up stoning adulterers. So it spoke to those two things. It also spoke to, I think, just the amazing variety of interpretation that you can find in the Bible. That this one phrase could be interpreted so many different ways. And this was especially, I learned a lot about the difference between the rabbinic tradition in Judaism and the literal Bible. Because in Judaism, there's the tradition, there's the Bible, the written word, and then there are the thousands of years of interpretations that the rabbis have made of these words. So, and these can be vastly different. For instance, there's the phrase in the Bible that you shall not boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. This is in Leviticus. If I'm taking the Bible completely literally, like I was doing for a year, I had to refrain from drinking, from eating boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk, which somehow I was able to do. My friend said I could always boil a baby goat in its grandmother's milk or its aunt's milk. Like, this would be my loophole. But I actually never had an extreme urge to do this, so I was able to stop. But the rabbis have interpreted this to mean something vastly different, to mean that you should separate milk and meat. And that's where we get the kosher laws of separation. And that's why we can't eat a cheeseburger. And you'll find this in Catholicism and to a lesser extent in Protestantism, but this, to me, it was fascinating to see the vastly different tracks that these words have caused. That these eight words could have changed thought patterns and behavior patterns in such a radical way for thousands of years. It was fascinating, and I think the third part I like about it is that that this allowed me to talk to my spiritual advisors, because that was one of my favorite parts of the year, was embedding myself in these various communities to see how they interpreted the Bible. So I went across the country. I visited with evangelical Christians and Hasidic Jews and the Amish. And I'm very proud because I think I'm the first person in history to out-Bible talk a Jehovah's Witness. He came over to my house, and after about 3.5 hours, he looked at his wife. He's like, "I gotta go." He was like, "That's enough." So, but I was just fascinated. I was fascinated by the topic, and I think that I feel that I went in to study this with an open mind and a deep curiosity, and not to mock or judge. So this, I think, really helped. I think they sensed that. These different communities sensed that, and that's why they were more open to me and let me sort of embed myself with them. And this, and I think this is probably unbiblical boasting, so you'll have to excuse me. But I'm very excited because I think so far, at least, it seems that the secular atheist agnostic community has received the book well, as has the religious community. This month, for instance, I am on the cover of an evangelical Christian magazine, but I'm also featured in Playboy and Penthouse. So that makes me commit the sin of pride. So I thought I would just give a couple of the bigger lessons that I learned from my year quickly, and then open it up to any questions you guys might have about my journey. The first is that thou shalt give thanks. This was a big one for me because the Bible has a lot of prayers of thanksgiving, and I started to become an extreme thanker. I was thanking not just before meals and after meals, but during meals, and thanking this water for not being poisoned. And it's a little bit of an odd way to live, but it's a great way to live, too, because you become aware of the 100 things that go right every day that we take for granted and that we never notice, instead of focusing on those 3 or 4 that go wrong. The second is thou shalt feel joy. This one was a lesson about religion. As a secular person, I sort of focused on the guilt and the sin and sort of the negative parts of religion. But I experienced times where religion really was a portal to this joyful, ecstatic state. I went to, for instance, a once a year ritual in Brooklyn. It's called Simchat Torah. It's a Jewish ritual where they celebrate. And I went to the Hasidic headquarters in Brooklyn, and it was an amazing experience. There were thousands of these black-hatted men. They were all drunk, so that helped. But they were dancing in this huge gymnasium, and it was such. I've never seen such pure joy. Thou shalt have reverence. This is one I learned because I started the year as an agnostic, but throughout the year I went through all sorts of permutations. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was praying all the time, at least 3 times a day. And as I mentioned before, your behavior shapes your beliefs. So I started to really get into it and started to believe. And at points, I really believed in a very loving and present God. After the year, after I stopped praying as much, I came out the other side as what a minister friend of mine calls a reverent agnostic, which is, I love the term, and I'm trying to get it, trying to start the movement. So if anyone wants to join me, that'd be great. It's the idea is that whether or not there's a God, there's something important about the idea of sacredness, and that the Sabbath can be sacred, our rituals can be sacred, prayer, our family time together can be sacred, and that's hugely important. Thou shalt not stereotype was another big one. Because every time I met community, all my preconceived notions about that community would crumble. So, for instance, the evangelical Christians, I really had a very preconceived notion about who they were, but it was totally off. It's such a wide movement that it's impossible to, it's very difficult to make generalizations about them. I spent some time with this group called the Red Letter Christians, which is an evangelical group. And they call themselves that because they focus on the words of Jesus, which were written in red letters in the old Bibles. And their argument says that Jesus never talked about homosexuality. That they, for instance, have a pamphlet that says, here's what Jesus said about homosexuality, and you open it up and there's nothing in it. Their argument is that Jesus talked a lot about poverty and poor and helping the others. And so that's what they focus their ministry on, and I find them very inspiring. And thou shalt not take the Bible literally, as I said before. I went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, for instance, which is this new museum, $25 million devoted to people who believe that the earth was created in 6 days. It's sort of the Louvre of the young earth movement. And, you know, these people were not stupid at all. They were, I would say their IQ is exactly the same as your average evolutionist. It's just that their faith is so strong that they'll distort all the data to fit this literal 6 day creation story. And I just don't think it's necessary. You can gain so much meaning from the Bible, so much wisdom, and without having to take every word literally. It doesn't destroy the Bible just because the Genesis story is not literally true. I will say, though, whatever you think of creationism, that museum, really spectacular production values. That place, they put some money into it, and it looks very good. There's a robotic dinosaurs with robotic cave people interacting, and there's you can watch a movie of the flood, Noah's flood, and they have sprinklers in the ceiling that will douse you with water. So it's quite well done. And then finally, I learned that thou shalt pick and choose. That I tried to follow the entire Bible without picking and choosing, and I failed miserably. And I came to the conclusion that you really do have to do some picking and choosing when following the Bible. And I believe that everyone does, whether or not they admit it or not. And there's a phrase, cafeteria Christianity, or cafeteria religion, to be broader. And this is used as a disparaging phrase for people who pick and choose the parts of the Bible they like and leave the other parts out. But my thought is, there's nothing wrong with cafeterias. I've had some great meals at cafeterias. I've also had some horrible meals at cafeterias. So it's all about choosing the right dishes, the right parts of the Bible. And however you do that, whether it's by an inspiring religious leader or with friends, I think it's important to focus on those parts of the Bible about compassion, tolerance, loving thy neighbor, and not on the parts about intolerance and violence, which, if we're going to be honest, are in the Bible as well. So it was a fascinating year. It was amazing. It took me from the sublime to the ridiculous and back to the sublime. And I just hope I'm able to share that enthusiasm in my book. So thank you very much for coming, and I'm happy to answer questions. Oh, yeah, we have to wait until the microphone comes, I guess, is the idea. Okay, yeah. Yes, sir.
What did you decide to teach your child?
What did I decide to teach my children? I actually, I decided at the end that I don't care if they become an atheist, like a Christopher Hitchens-like atheist, or whether they become very religious. I'll be happy either way as long as they're good people. But I did decide that I wanted to give them a little basis so that they know what they're rejecting or accepting. So I did, my wife and I did decide to join a temple. It's Reform, and we don't go very often, but it's there, and we are sending our son to Hebrew school just to give him a little taste, and then he can someday choose for himself. Yes, sir. Oh, wait, you're supposed to wait. Sorry.
Were you able to kind of create a personal meaning for the rituals that you went or that you did daily and weekly and well, whatever period? And what was the meaning you got out of that?
The question was about the meaning of the rituals. And, the rituals became – that was one of the bigger surprises is how the rituals started to affect me. Perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised because I do have mild obsessive compulsive disorder. So I had sort of been practicing these rituals all my life, but just my own crazy made up rituals, like, you know, touching the faucet 4 times before turning it off. So here was a book that actually had some time tested rituals, which, why not adopt them? And, you know, I'm not the first one to come up with this. It's, Freud's basically said that religion is a massive, neurotic delusion. I did start to love the ritual, and it really made me rethink rituals in a profound way because, for instance, there's the whole ritual of not wearing clothes of mixed fiber. And I thought I'm the only one in America who's going to do this. But in fact, there are Orthodox Jews who still follow this law, this ritual. And I actually, there's a guy you can hire in New York who will come to your apartment and look through your wardrobe and find the mixed fibers, specifically wool and linen. And at first, for the first part of my year, I sort of enjoyed laughing and, you know, it's very amusing because it is. It's crazy. It's bizarre. But as he and some others of my spiritual advisors pointed out, all rituals are, in a sense, irrational. There's no such thing as a completely rational ritual. If you think about it, a birthday cake, blowing out candles on a birthday cake. If a Martian came down and saw someone doing that and then someone not wearing mixed fibers, would they be like, well, that one makes sense, but that one is crazy. Like, they're both crazy. But the rituals can provide a meaning. They can provide a structure and a discipline, and there's something very attractive about that. As long as they're not harmful rituals, of course, which is where the danger of religion comes in. Yes. Oh, sure. Yes, sir.
These 700 rules that you uncovered, did you try to categorize them or prioritize them or do anything with them?
Well, I did, you know, I put them into all sorts of different categories, like, you know, eating rules, because there's lots of food taboos, rules about sex, because there's lots of that. And it was a question, you know, are some rules more important than others? You know, I think that generally, yeah, the Ten Commandments are kind of more important. But if you ask this guy who came over to my house, who inspected my mixed fibers, and I said, you know, not wearing a kosher blazer, is that really important? And he says, they're all commandments from God, they're all equally important. So that was his point of view. You know, in the end, I didn't end up adopting that, but it was an interesting point of view that they're all equal. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering what inconsistencies or contradictions did you come across?
The inconsistency, well, a reader sent me a nice quote from Ned Flanders of The Simpsons, the great theologian, who said, "Why, God, why is this happening to me? I followed everything in the Bible, even the stuff that contradicted the other stuff." So I thought that was a nice way to put it. But sure, you know, there were lots of times where rules would contradict other rules. And you had to pick and choose. Again, it comes down to this idea of picking and choosing, engaging the Bible, and not just saying, well, the Bible says X, therefore I'm doing X. You have to be an active participant. So, you know, everything from my wife would come home and start talking about how upset she was about a client, and I couldn't really, I'm not supposed to gossip or evil tongue, say evil tongue, as they say in the Bible. And since I didn't know this woman, I couldn't really say evil tongue. So I couldn't support my wife, and she got annoyed, and I think I chose the wrong one in that case. But I will say just quickly that my wife definitely is a saint for putting up with this, because there were these laws of sexual purity in the Old Testament where you're not allowed to touch women during certain times of the month. But if you take it really literally, the Bible says you're not allowed to sit on a seat where a woman in that time of month has sat. So my wife thought this was incredibly sexist, so she sat on every seat in our apartment during her impure time. And I had to spend a lot of time standing. So, any other questions? Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you ever heard from any of your sources about the old rituals and how modern technology may have solved some of them, like, you know, cooking your pork or, you know, using sanitary napkins and things of that sort. Are they acknowledged that modern technology can compensate for those, or is it always that way, ritual forever?
Right. Well, did everyone hear that, or should I repeat it? I heard it? Okay. Well, it is. It's a fascinating question, because it depends who you ask. I mean, there are people who say, yeah, you know, well, now we can cook pork, so we're not going to get trichinosis. So the laws about not eating pork are nullified. But if you talk to Orthodox people, they reject this completely, because they say, we don't know what the long-term benefits are. We'll never know the mind of God. And it's like the comparison I heard time and again from Christians and Jews was that God is like our parent and we're his children. God knows better than us. So when a parent tells the kid not to touch the fire, and the kid doesn't understand why, but the parent knows. So that's their point of view on that. Yes, sir.
The Old Testament has quite a few rules about sacrifices and offerings and when you have to offer them and what you have to do. I realize there's no longer a temple to which you can bring that stuff, but did you attempt any kind of substitute ritual?
It was about sacrificing. And yeah, it was a huge part of the Old Testament, and I knew I had to address it somehow. The first thing I tried to do was to sacrifice fruits and grains, because they do a lot of that in the Bible too. And it's not just animals. They put fruits and grains on the altar and leave them there. So I tried that, but it seemed sort of like second rate. So I decided I had to try this animal sacrifice, which is, you know, incredibly difficult because it's not something I relish. And the closest thing I could find to legal animal sacrifice in the tri-state area was this annual ritual called kaparot, which is practiced by some ultra-Orthodox Jews. And this one said, basically you get a live chicken and you hold it over your head and you say, you actually give your sins to the chicken. Then the chicken is killed by a kosher butcher in front of you. And then is given to the poor for eating. But and by the way, this is actually a derivation of the original ritual in the Bible, which was that you put your sins into a goat and ran it off of a cliff. And that is where we get the word scapegoat. That is the derivation of that word. So I did this. I went out one night and I did it you know, it was horrible. I didn't like it at all, especially because the chicken, his eyes reminded me of my son, my oldest son. He kind of, these bug eyes. So there's a lot of like Abraham and Isaac things going on, and it was just, it was not good. I mean, the intent of the ritual is not, it seems barbaric, and I didn't like it, but the intent of the ritual is to show that we should be grateful for life because we could be alive 1 minute and dead the next. And this is a reminder, there but for the grace of God go I. And that, I think, is a great lesson. But I did not like the means of teaching that lesson. And most Orthodox Jews now do not do it with the chicken. They hold money over their heads and give the money to the poor, which I find that's a much more palatable way to go about it. Anyone else? Yes, back in the red.
You'd mentioned like the hip hop Bible, and I know there's like a big movement towards like more like popular culture Christianity, especially. And do you think that's a good thing in the sense of like when the Bible or prayers were first printed in the vernacular? In that it's expanding its accessibility, or do you think that there's a more like insidious dumbing down to reach more people?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. I think there is that danger of dumbing down, but I would say probably the good outweighs the bad in trying to, you know, if you can start a dialogue using more contemporary parables. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's good to sort of reinvent and recreate. And that is that was one of the lessons of my year, was that, you know, religion has to evolve or it'll snap. You know, and that's why fundamentalism is so dangerous, is that they don't want to evolve, and they don't see that. There's a different, you know, if you ask a fundamentalist, the point of view is that the biblical times and our times, we basically thought exactly alike. It's just that they wore different clothing. But it really was a foreign land with a foreign mindset. And so we have to be able to engage that and evolve the meaning of the Bible. So I have nothing, you know, I'm not a purist. Maybe one more or two more? One or two? Sure. Yes.
What's your favorite book in the Bible and why?
My favorite book in the Bible, I love this book called Ecclesiastes. I don't know if you guys know, but I thought it was beautiful. It's the poetry, the writing is astounding. And I also like, it's actually a very modern book in a sense, because you know, I talked about how their mindset was so foreign, but in this book, it's actually almost modern, and it was a very weird experience to be reading this book where, I felt like I was connecting with the writer from 3,000 years ago. And one of the things he talks about is that bad things happen to good people, basically. And, you know, the race does not go to the swift, as he puts it a little more poetically. And this goes against some of the proverbs, which say, you work hard, you will be rewarded in this life. You work hard, you'll become rich, you'll get lots of sheep, you'll get, many children. But Ecclesiastes says it doesn't work that way. We don't know the mystery of life. We don't know the mystery of God. And I just thought that was very powerful, and it really rang true to me, because, you know, I there are a lot of evil people in the world who are, you know, they who are doing just fine, and, you know, some of them have reality shows, and you know, they're wealthy, and it's so I find that it embraces the mystery of life. Yes, sir, in the blue.
Yeah, I was just wondering, after conducting this experiment and talking to all the different people you talked to, why you think it is that the fundamentalists, you know, different faiths and people who do try to take the Bible literally are doing so well lately? Like, what is it about fundamentalism that is, you know, doing so well in, you know, the last decade?
Right.
Or whatever?
Why is fundamental? Well, I think it's a stability and it's absolutism in this world where it's increasingly unstable, and the absolutes are fading away. And I mean, that when you talk to these creationists, and they'll say, if you can't trust, they say it's a slippery slope. It's the slippery slope argument. If you can't trust that the Bible says, when it says day, and God created the world in 6 days, then why should you trust anything else? So they say you knock one leg out from the Bible and the whole thing collapses. It's a hard argument. It's a hard argument to refute. And I did ask all of my spiritual advisors about that, and they all admit, we don't have a real answer for that. But the key is that even if the Bible is imperfect, even if it contains fallacies, it still is a, some people call it a finger pointing to the moon. So it's sort of a way to get into a more spiritual state, or another one of my spiritual advisors said it's like a photograph of the divine. And photographs are never perfect. They're smudged. They can be out of focus. There can be a thumbprint in them, but they can still be useful and still provide you a glimpse of something. So, well, thank you guys so much for coming out. That was very nice.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.